This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Breaking news. The Associated Press reports voters in Ohio reject a proposed constitutional change that would have raised the threshold required to amend the state's constitution through the ballot box, making it tougher to protect abortion rights. A 24-hour strike by city workers in Los Angeles. CBS's Mark Strassman says 11,000 sanitation traffic officers and others are walking.
Think of all this as a warning shot, a 24-hour reminder of what disruption feels like.
Here in L.A., it's a cost of living.
Custodian Phyllis Stringer echoes the frustrations of hundreds rallying outside City Hall. Double trouble, low wages, high inflation.
We need some help.
You're working too hard and making too little?
Yes, yes. You know, we need a lot of more employees to come out to work with the city.
A judge sentences rapper Tory Lanez to 10 years in prison for shooting and wounding hip-hop star Megan Thee Stallion in 2020. Montgomery, Alabama authorities have charged three white men with misdemeanor assault after they allegedly attacked the black co-captain of a riverboat. It was caught on video as the co-captain tried to get the men to move their pontoon boat so the riverboat could dock. Montgomery Police Chief Daryl Albert.
While the Harriet was still out in the water, there was a lot of obscene finger gestures and comments and innuendo was made at a distance. Of course, when the co-captain approached, that continued.
Authorities say more charges are likely. Quite a catch for the mayor of Tampa, Florida, during a recent fishing trip. As Mayor Jane Castor and her family were on their way back to shore, they spotted a big one. Not a fish, but a 70-pound package of cocaine.
My family was concerned, like, oh my gosh, what if they think it's ours? I'm like, oh, come on. So we pulled it up, and then as soon as we were in cell phone range, just to call and notify them.
The estimated street value of the cocaine, $1.1 million. A federal regulation cracking down on so-called ghost guns is back in effect temporarily. CBS's Allison Keyes in Washington.
The Supreme Court is putting the Biden administration's regulation restricting the sale of ghost gun kits back into effect. The privately made firearms do not have serial numbers and are increasingly showing up at crime scenes. But Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson explains.
Not all regulations of guns will be overturned by the Supreme Court, but it's going to be a fight.
The Biden administration asked the Supreme Court to step in while it appeals a ruling from a federal judge that invalidated its regulation cracking down on the sale of ghost gun kits.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. This week, a Chippewa County judge will decide whether the lone suspect in last year's murder of 10-year-old Lily Peters will be tried as an adult or if the case will move to juvenile court. A 15-year-old boy is charged with killing Peters and leaving her body in the woods near her home in Chippewa Falls on April 24, 2022. He's being charged with homicide and two counts of sexual assault. If he's tried as an adult and convicted of homicide, he would have to serve a mandatory life sentence. Judge Stephen Gibbs ruled that autopsy photos and videos would be sealed and would address other evidence as the hearings continued this week. Hearings will continue this morning after four witnesses took the stand yesterday. A ruling on where the case will be tried won't happen until at least tomorrow, the earliest day that some of the witnesses will be able to appear in court. And the National Weather Service in the Twin Cities says that today will be hot, highs in the mid to upper 80s, but rain chances are on the way tomorrow and the rest of the week. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
It doesn't hurt, feels good to help. And when you give blood, you provide a life-saving difference for others. The need doesn't take a summer break. So we have a challenge for you, started by Civic Media's Earl Ingram.
Congratulations to all those people and all of you who donate blood.
Take a selfie while giving blood, then post it along with hashtag Civic Pints. Give blood and you could get a prize, too. Find challenge details and a donation center near you at civicmedia.us/giveblood. civicmedia.us/giveblood.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Because I joined last night and I'm hopeful. Wow. I'm hopeful that it is more fun than Twitter has been lately, because Twitter has not been that fun lately.
I do wish it weren't those two.
I know. It's a weird thing to be cheering for Mark Zuckerberg right now.
I'm choosing between the Joker and the Penguin. This is not a winning solution.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Jane Mattenair. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, yeah. StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there? I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Kreutz. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. It's what's on tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5, The Tap.
Or Amazon Podcasts. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Bidenomics. Inflation at its lowest level in more than 2 years. Unemployment rate below 4% for over a year and a half, longest stretch in 50 years. Share of working age Americans who have jobs at a 20-year high. 13.4 million jobs created. It seems like we're going in the right direction. Now what we do is we organize those jobs and make sure that those jobs pay a living wage so that people can afford to not to have two or three jobs. I still remember George W. Bush. A woman goes, you know, I have three jobs. And he goes, wow, that's great. That's uniquely American. It's great that you do that. And I don't think that's not where the woman was going. The woman was going, look, I work three jobs because I have to. I have to make ends meet. And he's like, no, that's fabulous. It's great you got three jobs. Everyone should have three jobs. That's what got us into the mess and where we are today. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
I'm insane. Does that sum it up?
Okay. Well, what's on your mind?
What I wanted to say is I believe that the union's coming back, and then also the voters starting to turn out like in Ohio. I think what's going on is people, and I'm not talking about the extreme right wing, people are starting to wake up and they're going, you know what, wait a minute here. I think I'm just a little bit tired of, you know, your religious beliefs being pushed down my throat or your erroneous economic policies being shoved on the rest of us. And I really do. I think people are starting to pay attention. The people in the middle are starting to pay attention. Because, you know, for the most part, most of us, you know, you have your extreme, your two extremes, and then most people in the middle, we really don't pay attention unless something really bad is going on. And I think that people are starting to go, well, you know, wait a minute here. What did I hear? Because social media, though it can be bad, it can also be good because we're more exposed. You know, we don't pay attention to the newspapers anymore, and we don't watch the news like my dad did when I was a kid. But people are able to share stories more. So I really think that the people in the middle are starting to pay attention.
I think you're right. I just hope it turns into electoral victories. But, yeah, I appreciate the thoughts, though. Thank you.
I have a good evening.
And to highlight that, and I'm glad she brought that up, because, you know, I've been seeing on social media, and this fits right into where I wanted to go. On social media, I've been seeing a lot of people around my age, you know, whose kids are now entering the workforce, getting out of college. They're trying to find places to live. They're trying to pay their bills, and they're struggling. They're struggling to find jobs. And the question of what happened to the American dream has popped up. And the thing is you've got all these people, you know, asking, why are my kids struggling much harder than I did? And look, when we were younger, we struggled. It's, you know, everyone admits that, you know, it's different today. You know, when I started at the job, you started at the bottom, and you knew that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you stuck it out, you'd get some seniority, you'd move ahead, you'd get that promotion. There was some loyalty there from the company to help move you along. Now it's just about churning people out. It's now just using and abusing and getting them to work as gig workers and trying to screw them in every way possible. So what you end up having is these people who are, you know, overeducated with lots of, you know, paper degrees who are still living in their parents' houses or not able to pay their rent and their student loan bills. And look, I worry about my kids' future. You know, what jobs are going to be here in 20 years? I think about the kid that's growing up in the place in the housing project that I grew up. What opportunities is that kid going to have to at least have the same opportunities that I did? And I know we talk about the American dream a lot. We talk about the idea that, you know, hey, you know, in this country, in America, if you're willing to work hard, you can have success, that you can have upward mobility. You just got to work hard enough. You can have prosperity if you just work hard enough. And we've internalized it, and people are out there working their butts off. You know, hard work, determination, equal opportunities, yes. And we've internalized this to believe that, yeah, this is, it's our birthright. And the sad reality is the gap between the rich and poor just keep getting bigger and bigger. We've got massive income inequality. And again, it's back to the reason that we've talked about it numerous times. The fact that union density is at almost at the level it was when it was illegal. Social mobility has pretty much stopped. Studies have shown that whatever class you were born into, whatever rung on the socioeconomic ladder you were born onto, probably where you're going to stay, maybe even fall a little bit. And then you throw in the rising cost of the inflation, the rising cost of housing, healthcare, education, you name it. People are struggling. And then on top of that, massive student loan debt, and you go, that American dream we were all sold sounds a lot like a nightmare for some people. And I go back to, you know, I was able to live off of a generation that had a vision for the future. They demanded a fair share of the wealth that their labor created in the workplace. And it showed. You know, there are a bunch of great graphs out there that show, you know, from the end of World War II until the mid-1970s, as productivity, you know, skyrocketed, wages went up with it at the equal rate. Workers got a share. You know, it was actually a meritocracy. They got the same share of wealth that they created. And it worked. And then middle 70s, all the way through towards to now, it's been deadline. People are actually, you know, making less than my grandparents' generation did. And it's finally now Joe Biden who's saying, look, something's not right. We need an industrial policy that's going to bring those jobs back. And I think Biden's got to do a lot more talking about, and I think he does some of it, but I think there have got to be a lot more stories of him talking about, you know, hey, you know, when the father came home from work and the pride that, you know, hey, you did the job, things are going to be okay. You know, we've got a future here. There's going to be opportunity. That positivity that came out of my grandparents, when they got married, my grandfather came back from the war. They got married for the old fashioned reason. They had to. My aunt, their firstborn, Came a little early, as I'm told, you know, the old wives' tale. The first one always comes early. But when they got married, they were living in their car. Because my grandmother's parents threw her to the curb, and my grandfather was basically, you know, homeless, because, you know, they were dirt poor. And from that beginning, got a job, you know, thanks, you know, Franklin Roosevelt for passing the minimum wage, at least got, you know, the quarter an hour, and then got that union job. And my grandfather talked about, you know, getting that job, that it was a tough job shoveling coal off the back of a coal, you know, truck 12, 16 hours a day. But it paid. It paid well. It paid enough to get them a place to stay and then to be able to raise a family. And then, you know, became a truck driver and, you know, all this stuff. And because of that union job, was able to lead a solidly middle class existence. And that's the story of millions of people. So when I see these TikTok videos of mothers going, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know how to tell them anything. They're struggling. And their struggles are real. And this, again, is where I come back to smart policy is how we deal with this stuff. Education policy is how we deal with some of this stuff, healthcare. And I think Biden's doing what he can in this moment. Look, there's no more legislation going to be passed in this term. Maybe in 2024 when he's reelected, and maybe if you get a Democratic Congress, maybe you get something, you know, to add on to help us move forward even further. But that comes back to us. That comes back to the voters doing what they did today in Ohio, holding Republicans accountable when they overreach. And I say this all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. The unholy marriage of the Republican Party and conservative Democrats brought us the world that we're in. Brought us the struggle of the moment that workers are in. I see things turning around. And this is why we need to come together more than we are and put down the red hat and the blue hat and get that hard hat, and because we've got a lot of rebuilding to do. Just seems like now's the time. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or give us a call, 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kamala Harris was in Philadelphia talking about prevailing wage. What's that? I know, right? Going to come back with that. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So So Kamala Harris was in Philadelphia today at the Finishing Trades Institute. It's the place where the building trades teach their apprentices how to do glazer work, how to do drywall installation, painting, build stuff. And the apprenticeship programs are some of the best that you're going to get into. You get paid to learn. You learn a craft that is portable. You can take it with you the rest of your life. But she was there at the Finishing Trades Institute in Philly talking about prevailing wage and how the administration is going to change the prevailing wage laws back to the way that they used to be, from the New Deal through right around 1983 when the Reagan administration and, again, conservative, Republican, corporate Democrats, those ilk, began attacking prevailing wage. And we've seen the attacks all across this country. There are a number of states, Iowa, oddly enough, being one of them, that went and repealed their state, their baby bacons, their state prevailing wage laws. On the national level, it's called the Davis-Bacon Act. On the state levels, you have prevailing wage laws, or they call them baby bacons, that are just on the state level. And what they say is, look, and this, again, this is very much New Deal, my grandparents' generation thinking. And it's not wrong. It's actually smart policy. It's saying, look, if we're going to use tax dollars to build a road, to build a bridge, to build a school, to build a hospital, to build anything, whatever we, the citizens, need, whatever procurement our tax dollars are going to pursue, we should be pursuing high road employment. We should be ensuring that the people who are doing those jobs have some decent wages, have decent benefits, have good working conditions, stability, all that stuff. And she was in Philly today to say, look, we're going to move back to that era. And what's interesting to me is how little we know about prevailing wage. And this is one of those things that I remember years ago, I was giving a presentation to the building trades and I got in trouble for it because what they heard and what I said were two completely different things. I said, look, there are people out there who are rallying against prevailing wage, who are, holding these demonstrations against prevailing wage. And in the media, everyone is saying, look, it must be bad because there are people out there who are against it. And, our voice is one of the few out in the media structure saying, hey, there's a benefit to this. In states that have done away with their prevailing wage laws, think Iowa, think West Virginia. Oddly enough, West Virginia, their Republican governor, Jim Justice, who did both passed the whole no rights at work thing, no right to work law, and repealed prevailing wage, came out not too long after and said, hey, we did all that, didn't help. We were told it was going to be the panacea. It was going to bring us jobs. It was going to be fabulous. And it made things worse. And there's a definitive study on this that was done years ago about Iowa, where when they did away with their prevailing wage laws back in the, I think it was back in the 80s, what they found was that the people who were in the building trades were sufficiently talented enough to find other jobs. So as the wages went down in those jobs, they were able to find other employment, start their own businesses, find other employment. And what happened then is you ended up getting transients coming through. You would get, fly-by-night transient, contractors to come through. And, they would underbid things and they would do a shoddy half-you-know-what job and take off. And here you're left with this halfway done monstrosity that you overpaid for because you had to pay somebody to come in and do it right. And you still don't have a local building trades because all those people left. And that had played out in a number of other places. That's been kind of the reality of what we know. you have these skilled craftspeople who are like, you know what, if I'm not making a good living doing this, I'll go do something else because I have the opportunity to do that. And then you get these contractors like, well, I got to get anybody. So, hey, let's get that crew that, you know, I don't know what they build, but they'll slap something together. And as I've always said, I want the person building the school that my kid is, that my kid's sitting at. I want that person who's building that. I want that person's kid sitting next to mine. Because I'll know the roof was put on right. I want to know that the people who do this work have a vested interest in it being done the best possible way. Now, whenever I talk about prevailing wage and also project labor agreements, I can't talk about any of it without the tale of two bridges. And for those who have never heard this, the reality is you've got two bridges, one on each coast. You've got the Tappan Zee in New York, and you've got the Bay Bridge in California. The Bay Bridge, they thought was going to cost like $250 million a number of years ago, actually ended up costing something like $6.5 billion. Yeah, that's a big difference. And it's actually, from what I understand, never going to be actually completed. It's never going to be done because it keeps breaking things. You know, the Chinese steel that they use, the Chinese cables, the Chinese welders, because they didn't use prevailing wage or project labor agreement. They went and they thought, we're going to get cheaper labor. We're going to be able to cut corners and bring in these shoddy contractors who did shoddy work. Now, you go to the New York Bridge, the Tappan Zee, which was all done under a project labor agreement, all with prevailing wage labor, done not just on time, but early, and not just on budget, but under budget. And done, actually done. And a very beautiful bridge. I've been over it a couple of times. Very much better than the old Tappan Zee, which was actually on wooden floats that were rotting. Did not give me great confidence going over that bridge. But this is the difference in what you get. So now you've got the administration saying, we're going to go back and we're going to strengthen these prevailing wage laws to ensure that workers get a fair shake, get a raise, and that we attract the best people into these jobs. Now, I've had people say, but Rick, you know, those are the prevailing wage. That's just the union wage. And you go, no, it's the prevailing wage. It's the wage most often paid in that area for that job. You got 10 people working at the same job, and six of them are making $9 an hour, and two are making three, and two are making seven. The prevailing wage is $9 an hour. So if you're going to do that job on a federal contract, everyone gets paid $9 an hour to do that job. This is how you end up raising the wages. And I've talked to non-union contractors and non-union labor, and they love prevailing wage jobs. Only one problem with them, and this I've heard this over and over and over again. All of these guys who work in construction love prevailing wage jobs because they get paid better. They get benefits. They get health care and retirement money. They get all this stuff. It's great. Problem is you get these contractors who screw them out of prevailing wage, misclassify them, and then pocket the money themselves. Which is why one of the knocks against prevailing wages is its lack of enforcement. The unions do what they can, and they police it as best they can. They do a good job doing it. But there's always someone out there trying to cheat working people. And this is where the Biden administration is saying, we're going to streamline some of this. We're going to make it easier to make sure that people don't get cheated. And that we're going to make it that the money that we spend, the opportunities that we spend, benefit the community. Now, when the bridge collapsed in California during the earthquake, during the World Series, I think it was back in the 90s, there was a bridge that collapsed because there was an earthquake. They rebuilt that bridge fairly quickly. And they did it under a project labor agreement with prevailing wage. Well, what folks did is what the economists did at the time is they followed the money. And the reverberation effect of all of the money that was spent on that prevailing wage project and where it went. And the simple part, the simple line in this is if you pay workers more money, they're going to spend it locally. And that local money will reverberate and help small businesses locally. It's going to help Main Street. They're not out buying stock. They're not out, you know, buying yachts. They're not out buying mansions and vacation homes on the Riviera. They're going to the movies. They're going to the local diner. They're buying flowers for their wives. They're making their lives better. And everyone else in their community. So for me, the fact that the Biden administration is strengthening this, another huge, huge feather in his cap. And why working people really should be supporting Biden in this administration. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back with your thoughts, 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the day that two tailors who were out on strike in New York City were killed in a confrontation with the police. It is thought that they were the first workers to die while participating in a strike in the United States. They certainly would not be the last. The United States has one of the bloodiest labor histories of any industrial nation. It's estimated that at least 700 people have lost their lives to violence during a strike. The vast majority of those slain were workers. Some of the most bloody conflicts included the Great Upheaval of 1877, where across the country, 100 workers lost their lives in an uprising of railway labor. Then, in 1892, the strike against Carnegie Steel in Homestead, Pennsylvania, 9 strikers and 3 Pinkerton agents died. 2 years later, 30 workers died across the country in a boycott and strike against the Pullman Palace Car Company. One of the most infamous labor massacres occurred in Ludlow, Colorado in 1914. During this coal mining strike, gun thugs hired by the company rained machine gun bullets and fire down on a tent colony of striking workers. At least 19 people were killed. 11 of them were children. In 1937, 10 workers died on Memorial Day at a demonstration against Republic Steel in Chicago. These are just some of the battles, massacres, and murders that shaped the American labor movement. Too often, the toil of this bloodshed is not taught in history classes. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Weather forecasters across the Southwest are having a hard time this summer coming up with descriptive taglines for each day's ever-rising heat. If 105 degrees is hot, what to call 110 and up? Some have quit trying, simply labeling each day again. Luckily, Joe Biden has issued bold new steps to counter the relentless climate change that's causing this extreme killer heat. For example, workers will get hazard alerts telling them that it's hot. Also, a new website will urge everyone to stay hydrated. His aides say this shows that Joe is treating climate change with, quote, the urgency it deserves. Excuse me while I have a political heat stroke. Urgency? The same day Biden launched his pathetic global warming policy, the Republican Supreme Court rubber-stamped his disastrous push for the massively polluting Mountain Valley Pipeline. This 300-mile environmental scar across two states will be like adding 26 more coal-fired power plants to our climate change crisis. Then there's his unconscionable approval this year of Willow, an oil drilling project in the Arctic that will release hundreds of millions of tons of additional greenhouse gas emissions, plus approving and subsidizing dozens of other fossil fuel boondoggles. Worse, Biden has meekly refused to take the genuinely bold step of declaring a climate change emergency, even as he's pushed new laws to remove the people's right to challenge corporate profiteering at the expense of climate sanity. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, the Republicans are worse, but pointing that out is neither a policy nor good politics. Climate change is not a future problem. It is now. If Biden wonders why his approval rating is a woeful 39%, there it is. People want and need presidential boldness, not a hot weather website.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like Vivek Ramaswamy, he has become the first Republican candidate to qualify for the presidential debate, the first RNC committee debate, by signing the pledge. And the pledge is that you will support the party's nominee no matter what. And this is, again, Republicans are, they love pledges, don't they? We'll starve children. We won't do anything on taxes. We won't stop people from getting guns and shooting kids in the schoolyard. But we'll send thoughts and prayers. But Republicans are good at pledges, aren't they? I mean, lots of pledges. I think it's the mentality. I think it's that kind of, I do. I think it gives them some kind of comfort to know that I've signed a pledge. Whereas I'm going, wait a second, I don't think I'm ever going to tell you that I'm never going to sign a pledge that says I'm never going to do something. Or that I'm absolutely going to do something. I would never do that. And this pledge, you're gonna have to, if you want to debate, you want to be one of us, you want to be in the club, you've got to sign on that you will support the nominee. Well, what if it is Trump? Because understand, Trump is whipping everyone's behind. There's no one even close. And Trump would be an idiot to go through the debates. Because it's only down for him. He should hold his own event on the night of the debate. And mock them for having a debate without him. Because the party is that far gone. And now think of yourself. If you're Chris Christie, are you going to sign a pledge that says, you know, I've been hammering this guy? Yeah, are you Mike Pence? This is the guy that wanted me hung. I'm going to pledge to support the guy that wanted me to be hung. Are you freaking kidding me? But that's Republicans. They love their pledges. You know, it's like the tax thing, and they stuck to them, didn't they? The one thing I give George H.W. Bush credit for was not an H.W. fan. There are only two things I agreed with him on. I don't like broccoli and raising taxes when he had to. When he looked at the books and he said, oh my gosh, we're running up massive deficits. We should probably pay for our stuff. And then had to go back on his pledge of read my lips, no new taxes, because it was for the good of the country. And he got beaten for it. Lesson learned. And now Republicans understand this. So they give them these no tax pledges, which means, you know, I'm never going to raise taxes ever, 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 ever. Even if we go into, what are we at now? $35, $36 trillion in debt, all because of Republican tax pledges? You can't blame the Republicans for that. Yeah, I can. And I think I just did. Because it's them who moved us from a 70% tax rate all the way down to 28. It's them who said, no, we're going to ensure that the wealth class of this country gets to get all of the spoils, and workers, you can pick up the difference. This is one of those things that's just infuriating to me. Also, Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves is going to be facing Democratic challenger Brandon Presley in the Mississippi governor's race. And I think everyone knew this is where it was going to go. But Tate Reeves, you know, put down two challengers. Presley was unopposed. So we'll see what happens in November. There are some who think that the cousin of Elvis might actually have a chance, that Elvis's cousin may actually have a chance to, you know, be a Democratic governor in Mississippi? Oh, wow. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Let's quick go to the phones. Got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I think you raise a really important point there with regard to how we regard taxes and the need to fund the things that society needs in order to function. And unfortunately, I think, you know, as you pointed out, rightfully so, the Republican Party has adopted this sort of unofficial mantra that at no point is it worthwhile to raise taxes, no matter what we need to do. The fact is that taxes paid for the economic booms that have made this country what it is. You know, or the infrastructure that is necessary, the educational institutions, the healthcare institutions, these things that we paid for through taxes are how we elevated the economy, because it's not a zero-sum game. It's not as if you invest a dollar in infrastructure and therefore you lose a dollar other places. No, you invest a dollar in infrastructure and you get back 10 in productivity. But the Republican mantra seems to be, well, God forbid that we invest in anything because it's going to cost dollars. And that means we may have to raise somebody's taxes. Now, in the long run, we can't sell the fact that that's going to be beneficial for this society and this country. So instead, we're just going to be opposed to any hikes in taxes, anything other than perhaps needing to fund the military, which the Republican Party is always willing to do. But other than that, yeah, everything else is pretty much off limits. And as a result of which, you know, we've been living by a dream in terms of the things that we really needed to fund, like infrastructure, because we are decades behind and we still haven't passed enough in the way of infrastructure funding to repair and maintain the things that have decayed over many decades of neglect. And that's the problem. And again, this idea that society simply functions magically and without having to invest in anything and to repair anything and to maintain anything is just ridiculous. And we're trying to keep up in a global economy with India and China and so much of the rest of the world, that guess what? It's not 1946 anymore.
No,
you know,
right.
A lot of the rest of the world is caught up. And that means we have to try and stay competitive, and that means we need to invest in ourselves. But, you know, God forbid that we do that sort of thing.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers did a report, I think it was last year before, said $4.8 trillion is what we needed to get even. So the $1.2 trillion that Biden got through in the on the infrastructure bill, not even close to what we need. A good start, good first step, but not what the American Society of Civil Engineers say we need.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because as we all know, a lot of Americans, they don't leave the country, they don't travel very much. For people like myself who have traveled, and you've seen things like modern airports, you know, that are run on 21st century technology, you realize just how bad our system is.
Yeah.
You know, people come here from other parts, from Asia, from Europe. You know, we don't have high-speed rail. We don't have modern airports. I mean, and things are just falling apart. And, yeah, that's what happens when you don't invest. And instead, you decide that you need to create more and more billionaires and millionaires.
Yeah, I'm not a big Thomas Friedman.
It's going to catch up to you.
I'm not a Thomas Friedman fan by any stretch of the imagination, but he had a great line to emphasize what you're saying. He said he came from he went from Beijing to LAX, and he said it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a shame because, you know, we were once, you know, the cutting edge of advancement, the cutting edge of technology. You know, we were that shining city on a hill that, you know, we thought that was going to last forever. Well, guess what? The rest of the world kept modernizing, and we just kept holding on to what we had built in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And now we're paying for it.
No, you're spot on right. I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Take care.
And look, you know, Steve brings up a whole bunch of really good points, and thank you for validating some of mine. But, you know, as he was talking about, you know, conservatives believing in, you know, magic thinking, you go, well, yeah, that's who they are. You know, the person that's looking down to keep them to be decent human beings. You know, wanting those 10 rules plastered everywhere because they can't remember them. And then the invisible hand of the market that's supposed to, you know, magically do all this stuff, that there's no actual planning into any of this. But even more nefarious than that is their fetish of privatization. And as Steve was talking, I was remembering a conversation I was having with my teenage son, who is coming aware of, you know, politically of where we are and what the future is. He's turning into kind of a gearhead, you know, we're learning to ride motorcycles. You know, he's into cars now. So he's kind of starting to think about, you know, the world that he's going to inherit. And, you know, we were talking about EVs and electric cars and the future of, you know, driving, because, you know, we both we'll go out on the bikes and we'll ride for, you know, an hour or two or three. And he's like, you know, in the future, I don't think we're going to be able to do this. He goes, you know, I fear in the future that, you know, everything's going to be electric. All the cars will be on the grid. You know, the 5G will know everywhere where you are at every moment. And, you know, there won't be any more policemen to pull you over because the car will know if you're speeding. And he has this whole thing laid out that him and his friends talk about of what the future is going to be. Of, you know, look, if I want to do 100 miles an hour on my motorcycle, that I'll be able to do that. But it'll just tell me how much the fine is going to be to do it. And if you want to get to work 10 minutes earlier and you want to, you know, go into the, you know, the certain lane that's going to let you do 20 miles an hour more, it's going to cost you this much. Now, if you want to obey the traffic signs and deal with the traffic, you know, of course, that will still be, you know, somewhat free, but everything else is going to cost you. And as I was telling him, I go, that is conservative world. That's the world that they envision. Everything is for a profit. Everything is in the hands of a corporate interest, in the hands of someone seeking profit. Because in, I don't know if they actually believe this or if it's what, you know, their controllers are pushing. But when a handful of people control all of these levers of your life and you're paying them every month, every week, every day, they're going to make a lot of money. And I've often joked about, you know, when we go on vacation, it seems like, you know, the most exercise I get is putting my hand into my pocket and pulling my wallet out. Especially if you go to Florida, which we will not be going to again. DeSantis's Florida is, well, the cost of, you know, the rental costs have quadrupled over the last couple of years. It's crazy. But, you know, you go there and everything's privatized. You want to go to a public park? It's going to cost you, you know, $8 a head. You want to cross this bridge, it's going to cost you that much. You want to do this, every time you do anything, it's costing you. And he sees this and he understands that's conservative world. That's the future for him. And it's frightening because no one knows if the jobs are going to be able to afford those kind of scenarios. Instead of what my grandparents' generation built, which we had the commons. You know, you had public parks, you had, you know, public parking, you had public transit, you had public hospitals, you had things that the public did for itself through its tax base. You had public swimming pools that didn't cost you an arm and a leg to go to. I remember when I was a kid, it was this is sounding really old, and I'm only 56. It was a quarter to go to the Gunnings pool. Now, I think it's like $9 locally. I mean, it's crazy. But it's those things that the community used to do for itself that are now being pushed off. We've got to make a profit because we've got to pay someone. Our transit authorities have been, you know, almost profitized. Our turnpikes, our parking authorities, water and sewer, you know, our prisons. You know, those things that we used to do for ourselves, now you've got this special interest. And he sees this. And he's going, I don't know that this is the future I want. He goes, but I don't know that we can stop it. So right now, it's that kind of gallows humor where he's just joking about it. But I fear he's not wrong. And the rest of us should be too. So again, you know, it comes back to it's policy stuff. The stuff that really affects our lives, we don't seem to be talking about. You know what we're talking about? We're talking about who's drinking what beer and who's wearing a dress. And I don't care on all of those issues. I mean, and I've had these conversations before. I want people to lead their best lives. Don't care. I want people to be able to support their families and lead their best lives. That's where we should be. I don't care what my neighbor is doing. I don't care what the person across the street or across town or across the country. I don't care what they're doing. And we used to think like that as a society. now everybody seems to be all worried about what everybody else is doing and offended for everybody else. Maybe there's a way forward. I'm not sure. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Also going to take your calls, 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1994. President Bill Clinton posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Latino farm worker organizer Cesar Chavez. It is the highest honor granted to civilians. His widow, Helen, accepted the honor on his behalf. Chavez founded the United Farm Workers Union. He dedicated his life to organizing agricultural workers in California. Too often, agricultural workers have not received enough attention from labor leaders, despite their struggles to win better wages and improved conditions for themselves and their families. Chavez was one of the most important Latino labor organizers in U.S. history. In 1968, he helped lead a successful national boycott against California grape growers. The boycott won increased wages for those workers and demonstrated the power of the boycott in farm labor organizing. The medal ceremony was held in the East Room of the White House. United Farm Workers leaders attended the ceremony, including Dolores Huerta, the farm union's co-founder and first vice president. President Clinton's remarks in granting the medal captured the impact and sacrifice of this labor activist. President Clinton said, "The farm workers who labored in the fields and yearned for self-respect and self-sufficiency pinned their hopes on this remarkable man, who with faith and discipline, with soft-spoken humility and amazing inner strength, led a very courageous life, and in doing so, brought dignity to the lives of so many others, and provided for us an inspiration for the rest of our nation's history." In his life, Cesar Chavez never made more than $5,000 a year. And yet, the richness of his life and legacy left a lasting imprint on the cause of labor. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Show.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So the way it's looking, it looks like a 70-30 blowout. If that's what I'm looking at, that seems really high on the results in Ohio. That's got to be really high. That does seem kind of high. Now, the reality is I was pretty sure it was going to go down. And a lot, because the hypocrisy, the hypocrisy of no, we're not going to ban special elections, but oh, this one's so important. Now, the abortion issue again is I hate to say popular, but the number of people who I think are like me, I think most people. And this is where I'm gonna put this. I think most people are like me. I don't necessarily favor abortion. It's not something that I think is a good thing. But I want it safe and legal. I never want my daughters in a position to where they're in a back room alley or you know who knows where, and end up getting sick or end up getting an infection, and then they can't go to the doctor to get care because they end up getting an infection and horrible things happen. We've seen the history of this. I think most people are in this safe and legal. I don't say I'm pro-abortion or anti. I say I'm pro-safety. I want people to be safe. And I've always said that conservatives, if you were really against the idea of abortion, you should make it much better to bring children into this world. You should make it easier. You should make make, you know, parents have better opportunities to get health care, to get education, to get child care. You should be pushing policies. And we're in this moment where, again, me as a policy person who believes, you know, good policy makes people's lives better, bad policy makes people's lives worse. Because ultimately, government decides who gets what. And right now, they're deciding the wealthy get all they want. But for me, I'm looking at this as if conservatives were really pro-life, and I don't cede them that ground. My daughter and I were having this conversation today because she kept saying, you know, the pro-life people. I go, they're not pro-life. They're anti-abortion. Because they don't care about that kid. They don't give a tinker's damn about that kid when it's popped out. When it takes its first breath, you're on your own, buddy. Start whittling some bootstraps out of that umbilical cord, because we're going to get no help from us. And look, Iowa is the perfect example. You know, we talked to State Representative Sammy Sheets the other night, and he said, look, you know, they're trying to privatize education. They've privatized Medicaid. They're gutting the SNAP benefits. They're doing all this stuff to make it harder for poor and working class mothers to raise their children. And yet they want to force more people to have children that they can't afford. And the only decision that they're probably the only good decision they're making is by saying, no, I'm not ready to be a parent. And this was one of those things. My daughter and I were sitting at the pool today because I'm rehabbing my knee. And you go, you know, you need a license to get a dog. Anyone can be a parent, and now we're forcing people who wouldn't otherwise want to be parents, now we're forcing them to be parents. How many bad parents are we creating? Because we're sitting at the pool watching a lot of that going on. And then how much is society going to have to pay for, you know, all of the negative side of the negative consequences that come out of poor parenting? I don't see any of those policies from our Republican friends. And I want them. Look, I don't want people having abortions. I want them to bring children into this world. But I don't want kids brought into the kind of environment I grew up in, to see the kind of violence, to see the kind of poverty, to see the kind of horrible things that I remember as a kid. No one should have to go through that. And policy can make that better. But we don't have Republicans who think that way. Understand, being anti-abortion is not about being pro-child. It's about being anti-mother. This is about controlling women, not helping them. This is about controlling families, not helping them to thrive and survive. So for me, I look at these people pushing this agenda as punitive. I look at them as being, you know, retaliatory. I look at them as being all of the things that not good. And as one woman said to me, you know, how many of them are on the adoption list to take these kids? Not many. So for me, I would love to see some of those policies. So again, back to the drumming that the Republicans took over this. This is popular in the state. And I don't know that it wouldn't have reached the 60 vote threshold anyway. But this again is one of these moments where Republicans are drunk with power in Ohio, because they've gerrymandered the state so badly that they don't fear the electorate. They don't fear anybody going to vote them out. I don't know if this will be a wake-up call for them, or, you know, if they're going to, you know, who knows what they try next election? Because look, you know, someone, you know, tweeted over to us and said, hey, is this binding? And I'm like, well, I'm not quite sure what binding means. It means that come November, you're only going to need 50% plus one. It doesn't mean that come next August or next who knows when, or even in September, maybe they're going to run another special election. Who knows what these people will do? But for now, the law is in Ohio to amend your constitution. It's 50 plus one. And that is a victory for working people. So as I've said, will the voters of Ohio hold them accountable? I don't know. Don't know. Now, as I said, the Mississippi race is going to be Tate Reeves and Brendan Presley. What I find interesting, and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, that Mississippi election officials moved 161 voting precincts since November of 2022. That's less than a year. Have made 161 changes. And you can thank the U.S. Supreme Court for that, because they would have needed preclearance to do all that stuff.